Last time we talked about the conspiracy carried out by Queen Jezebel of northern Israel to confiscate the vineyard of Naboth of Jezreel, to give it to her husband, King Ahab, for his own personal vineyard and also for a little kitchen garden, since it sits just outside the walls of Jezreel, just outside the palace of King Ahab and Jezebel. And so all that's taken place. There was a big lie. There was a stoning. And now Ahab has what he wanted, thanks to the murderous, unfeeling actions of his Sidonian wife, Jezebel. Well, God's not going to let this stand. He's not going to let Ahab get away with it. And it will become the curse that falls upon Ahab and his family. 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 17. Then the word of he who is came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, so Elijah's back out in the open again. He got past his deep blue funk, and he is being protected now by a change in the attitude of the public in northern Israel. After the end of the drought, following the destruction of the prophets of Baal and the prophets or prophetesses of Asherah, a lot more of the Israeli people are open to declare that he who is the true God, and they are open to the ministries of people like Elijah and his protege Elisha and the sons of the prophets that probably are under the leadership of Elijah at this time and later under the leadership of Elisha. So wherever he's at, he is told to go on a mission. So the word of he who is came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who is in Samaria. Samaria, clearly in this context, is a region. And so, behold, he's in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone to take possession. Naboth's vineyard is on the, I think, east end of the city of Jezreel in the Jezreel Valley, which is a good day's chariot ride from the city of Samaria. So that's why I say this is probably a regional use of the word Samaria. But here's the message. You shall say to him, thus says he who is, have you killed and also taken possession? So God knows what happened, basically. You murdered a man to take his property. And then you shall say to him, thus says he who is, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick your own blood. So a curse is going to be put on Ahab that at the exact spot where Naboth was executed by stoning, and apparently the authorities allowed his body, or at least his blood, to be scavenged by the little scavenger dogs. And so Ahab is going to be told, you're going to have the same thing happen to your blood. And so Elijah takes off and goes to Jezreel. And he finds Ahab there at Jezreel, apparently by the vineyard, in the vineyard area that he's just taken possession of. And we will discover later that he has military commanders around him, one of whom is Jehu, who will listen to the prophecies on this day and carry them out. So keep that in mind. Verse 20, Ahab said to Elijah, "Have you found me, O my enemy?" So here comes Elijah. Elijah has a unique dressing style. It'll show up again for John the Immerser in the New Testament. He wears a hair-woven garment, perhaps it's camel hair, and a leather belt around his waist. There may be an indication that he has taken a Nazirite vow and doesn't cut his hair or his beard. So he's kind of a wild-looking guy. And so here he comes. Ahab sees him come and says, "Ah, you found me, my enemy, have you?" And Elijah said, "Oh, I found you because you have sold yourself to do what is evil in the sight of he who is." Yeah, I found you because God sent me here because you've been up to your bad stuff again. Behold, this is the message from God. I will bring disaster upon you. I will utterly burn you up and will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free, in Israel. So this is another part of the curse that's going to be placed on him, is that his dynasty is going to be dead-ended. His family tree is going to be chopped off and left only a stump. No more line of Omri's Ahab family. Verse 22, tying it in to the previous dynasties that God gave a chance to do the right thing and they didn't. Verse 22, "I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat." That was the first dynasty. It only lasted two kings. "And like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahiah." Also, same thing. Made promises from God that it could last if they would just do things God's way. Only lasts a couple of kings. "For the anger to which you have provoked me, and because you have made Israel to sin." So you guys are in trouble, just like these previous two dynasties. "And of Jezreel, he who is also said, the dog shall eat Jezebel within the walls of Jezreel." So Jezebel is the wicked queen who was involved in this up to her crown. And so the prophecy is made that she will be eaten by dogs. So file that away. It'll happen right there at Jezreel. And it does. Spoiler alert. Verse 24. "Anyone belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dog shall eat. And anyone of his who dies in the open country, the birds of the heaven shall eat." And so that's the exact same curse that God put on the Jeroboam dynasty and on the Baasha dynasty. Nobody's going to be able to go to the tomb intact. If they keel over inside the city, somehow dogs will chew on them, the scavenger dogs. If they die out in the countryside, they'll end up getting pecked at by the birds before their body's recovered and placed in the tomb. That's just the way it's going to be. We have a little note here from the prophet writer as to why this is all happening. Verse 25, "There was none who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of he who is like Ahab, whom Jezebel his wife incited." So that's the reason why I said earlier, she's kind of the power player in this power couple. She is the one that has been the mover and shaker in their relationship. Verse 26, he acted very abominably in going after idols, as the Amorites had done, whom he who is cast out before the people of Israel. So he was an idolater from the beginning of his life, apparently. And he and Jezebel had actually tried to wipe out any type of worship of he who is. That's now been reversed somewhat by the work of people like Elijah the prophet. But he continued to uphold all of that idolatry his entire kingdom. Verse 27. A couple of interesting things happen now. Despite him being a bad guy, Ahab does respond to this warning that he has crossed lines. When Ahab heard those words, he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his flesh and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went about dejectedly. Now, that's all the symbolic action that you would do if you were seeking God's forgiveness for a sin you acknowledged. So in some sort of weird way here, Ahab, this horrendous king, apparently felt bad enough about the things that he'd been doing that he went on a fast, dressed up in the sackcloth, and went around praying for God's forgiveness. Perhaps he was a little bit scared about what he'd been told was going to happen to him, but it was evidently genuine enough at the moment that God responds to it. Verse 28, the word of he who is came to Elijah the Tishbite saying, have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Now, typically when we see this word humbled in a context like this, it is focused on the idea that the person is repenting and demonstrating that repentance by fasting and praying and even denying himself comfort, and whether in where he's at or what he's wearing. So God's response is, Elijah, have a look at this. Can you see how Ahab is genuinely repentant in front of me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the disaster in his days, but in his son's days, I will bring the disaster upon his house. So at this particular moment, and I believe it's just 2 years before Ahab's death, he is repentant enough that God decides not to crash his kingdom during the remainder of his life. He's going to let him keep the throne and not execute him immediately. Now, very quickly, Ahab's going to get past his humility, get past his repentance, and he'll go back to his other stuff. So I think we can debate a little bit about whether or not it was genuine here, but because of God's wording, God's response, I think it probably was genuine. He just didn't stick with it. And it may be that Jezebel was egging him on the whole time. Chapter 22, verse 1 tells us this. For 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war. So they had 2 years of war. Israel cleaned the clock of the Syrians during those 2 years. The second battle, the second year, Ben-Hadad appealed for some sort of peaceful arrangements, a peace treaty that involved inter-cooperative trade in their capital cities. And so Ahab agrees to that, and so we have a little bit of a lull in the usual fighting between these two geographical neighbors. In those years, I believe we can pin them down to 865, 864, and 863 BC. Verse number 2, but in the third year, so that would be 863. Let me tell you a little bit about that year. By my calculations, that would have been the 79th sabbatical year of the Jewish people in the land. And so they are supposed to be taking the year off of their normal work and reflecting upon their life, reflecting upon their situation. And it would appear that King Jehoshaphat from southern Judah decided during this sabbatical year to come for a visit to Samaria in the north, because he has a marriage treaty with King Ahab. Jehoshaphat's son, his heir, is married to the princess of northern Israel, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. Shouldn't have happened, but it did. My guess, and that's all it's worth, is that it was probably proposed by King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, and Jehoshaphat accepted it as a possible mechanism of bringing the two kingdoms back together. Because you would think of it in this fashion. If the prince of Judah marries the princess of Israel, their baby son is going to have a right to both thrones. And so that is probably the reason why these two families are related by marriage now. Regardless, in the third year, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. Now, for us, we'd say came up, because we always say anything to the north is up. But from a Jewish perspective and Israeli perspective, anything that departs from Jerusalem is down. Anything that is coming toward Jerusalem is up. That's just a way of thinking. So he went down to the king of Israel, and the king of Israel said to his servants, "Do you know that Ramoth Gilead belongs to us, and we keep quiet and do not take it out of the hand of the king of Syria?" So way back, a few decades ago, the Syrians of Damascus under Ben-Hadad had invaded northern Israel, and they took cities that were in the Jordan Valley from Dan all the way down to the Sea of Galilee area. There's also indication that they pushed southward along the east shore of the Sea of Galilee and along the east side of the Jordan River Valley as far south as Ramoth Gilead. And when the Syrians recently lost to the Israelis, they agreed to give back the cities of the northern Jordan River Valley and the Sea of Galilee area, but they had not evidently agreed to give back the Golan Heights and Gilead that are all on the east side of the Jordan Valley river system. So at this meeting between the two kings, Ahab brings up this subject. You know what? The Syrians have control of property that belongs to the Israeli nation. Why aren't we taking it back? Now, verse 4, He then said to Jehoshaphat, "Will you go with me to battle at Ramoth Gilead?" So we've been at peace for 3 years. It's been 3 years since we were fighting with Syria. But Syria currently has Israeli property. Property that was given through the work of Moses as the annexed territory. Will you help me take it back? Will you make northern Israel whole again? Now, again, I think that these two groups are working on coming back together as a single kingdom. So Jehoshaphat more than likely would have seen it as a reasonably good thing to do. So Jehoshaphat said, Jehoshaphat said back to him, "I am as you are. My people are your people. My horses are your horses." So he says, "Sounds like a good idea. We're all united in this. Sure." But, verse 5, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "Inquire first for the word of he who is." Now keep in mind, Jehoshaphat is the good guy. Even though he made the foolish decision to allow his son to be married to a paganized princess, in every other aspect, he does pretty well. He's been complimented by God on that. And so he is totally devoted to he who is. He does not worship any other gods and goddesses. So his response is, "I think we need to check in with Yahweh." Now, Ahab is a follower of Baal. He is a follower of Asherah. But he is also very pragmatic. And so he has probably been telling himself and anybody that would listen to him that Baal and Yahweh are just different names for the same God. In fact, the southern Israeli Judeans, from time to time in their past history, had referred to Yahweh by the Canaanite word Baal, because in its most basic form, the word Baal means Lord or Master. So Baal could be sold by Ahab, at least in his mind, as being Yahweh. And so, verse 6, the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men. So we're back to the 400 pet prophets of Baal. And he said to them, "Shall I go to battle against Ramoth Gilead, or shall I refrain?" So, should I go or should I stay? They said to him, "Go up, for the Lord," the word is not the divine name. It's not Yahweh here. It's Adonai in the text, which is roughly Hebrew equivalent of Baal. They said, "Go up, for Adonai slash Baal will give it into the hand of the king." Verse 7. But Jehoshaphat said back to this, "Is there not here another prophet of Yahweh, he who is, of whom we may inquire?" So he is very specific. He doesn't think that these 400 prophets are tied in with the God he wants to know from. So he says, "I want a Yahweh prophet." Well, it just so happens that Ahab has a Yahweh prophet, but he's on ice. The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "There is yet one man by whom we may inquire of he who is." Now, Elijah is somewhere in the kingdom, but it doesn't even come to the mind of Ahab to look for him. He goes to this guy that he has in his dungeon. Micaiah, the son of Imlah, but I hate him, for he never prophesies good concerning me, but evil. And that's probably why he's in jail right now. It's because he won't do anything except what God says to pass on to King Ahab. And that's got to be negative. Then the king of Israel summoned an officer. Jehoshaphat said, "Let not the king say so. If he's a prophet of Yahweh, let's hear from him." So the king of Israel summoned an officer and said, "Bring quickly Micaiah, the son of Imlah." Now, the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, were sitting on their thrones, arrayed in their robes, at the threshing floor, at the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets were prophesying before him. So now we get a visualization of what's going on with this meeting. It's out in the public, and they're sitting on their thrones, they're in their royal regalia, and the prophets are all in front of them, but they're the prophets of Baal. Verse 11, Zedekiah, the son of Kenaanah, made for himself horns of iron as something to be used as an object lesson. And he said, "Thus says he who is." So he actually invokes the name Yahweh here, probably at the prompting of the situation, knowing that that's who Jehoshaphat wants to hear from. And again, these guys up in the north, they probably think they are worshiping Yahweh when they worship the golden calves and when they worship Baal. "Thus says Yahweh, with these you shall push the Syrians until they are destroyed." And you can picture that, can't you? This guy running all over the place, acting like a bull, pushing at things, and saying, "That's how you're going to do it." Verse 12. And all the prophets prophesied so. So, you know, the other 399 of them. And they said, "Go up to Ramoth Gilead and triumph. He who is," you know, Yahweh, "will give it into the hand of the king." So that's the scenario that's going on right now. And Micaiah is going to be brought into that environment as to whether or not that's really what Yahweh has to say on the topic. Come back next time. We'll see how that plays out.